You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Wait. Before we start, just want to make sure we're clear here. While this podcast talks about sobriety, mental health, and addiction, it is not meant to replace professional medical advice. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety.
I'm Kathleen.
And I'm Sonia.
And we're ex-sisters-in-law, brought together in marriage and bonded through our sobriety journey.
Join us as we talk sobriety, addiction, and everything in between. You're in for quite a ride. And our Substack is buzzing with amazing content, from creative mocktail recipes to insightful courses and reflective exercises. There is something for everyone. Don't miss out. It's a great way to add some extra joy and depth to your journey. Check it out. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety. This week, we are sitting down with the incredible Dr. Vera Tarman, an addiction medicine expert, an author, a speaker, and an all-around powerhouse in the field of recovery. You might know her as the medical director of Renascent, one of Canada's leading addiction treatment centers, or as the voice behind the popular Food Junkies podcast and the best-selling book, Food Junkies, Recovery from Food Addiction.
But what makes Dr. Tarman's voice so powerful isn't just her clinical experience. It's her own lived story of sobriety from both alcohol and food addiction. She knows firsthand the complicated dance between sugar, substance use, and emotional regulation, and she's here to share what it really takes to break free from that cycle.
In this conversation, we'll explore her personal recovery journey, the hidden ways food and alcohol intersect, and how we can all start making peace with what we put on our plates and what we reach for when we're hurting. Welcome, Dr. Tarman. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for asking me. I'm pleased.
Can you share a little bit about your journey and how your struggles with food and alcohol began?
A lot of times when people talk about food addiction, they'll remember sugar or food as being their primary first addiction. And then they found another addiction because you don't want to eat when you're using cocaine. You don't need sugar when you're drinking.
Yeah.
I've puzzled over this one. I can't say food was my first but I think it might be that I just didn't have access. I grew up in a time when people really did, especially if they were trying to be good parents, didn't have sugar in the house all the time. I guess I lived a long time. This is a long time ago. And we didn't like cereal and stuff. So I didn't have access except during Halloween and Christmas. And I certainly liked those times to eat sugar. And I would always eat too much. But it never crossed my mind that I had a problem. So I think my problem started really in my 17, 18 when I started to drink alcohol. And I had an experience. My mother was an alcoholic and actually died of alcoholism. So I was very aware that alcohol was something that was bad. And I knew that it was not a choice. I could see in her life that it was not a choice. So I thought, well, I'm not going to drink because I see that's a problem. So I did what most people in my generation did. I looked for drugs, especially marijuana, and LSD was very popular in my day. And so I really went for that stuff. In my day, too, it was really hard to get those kind of drugs without a man attached. You couldn't just as a female say, hey, I want something. Now you can, absolutely, but not in those days. And so I eventually reluctantly went to alcohol when I was about 19 or 20. And then I saw that I started to drink the word I often is violently. Like I drank, I would get very angry and rageful, and I got into a lot of trouble. But I was also wanting to go to university. And so by mid-university, I thought I have to stop because these are not compatible. So that's when the food story started, because I stopped the alcohol, which was, again, quite violent, like getting into trouble all the time. And I picked up the food. And actually, there was a period of time where I thought, I'm just going to clean up my life, and I'm going to, you know, jog all the time and eat well and all that stuff. So I restricted eating, and I guess what we would now call bulimic throwing up at that point. I got into food issues, which initially looked like anorexia and then binge eating disorder. Those terms didn't exist in those days. But something was happening with my food, and it hadn't happened before the alcohol, which is why I'm convinced that it's all connected somehow, even if it's just turning on the addictive flame in the brain, which, of course, is just an analogy. And I knew that that was a problem, too. But I could still do university. I could still do my courses, because food, although at a certain point, it dominated my mind. I could still, in the thicket of all the thoughts of food and how do I get rid of it and should I throw it up? Should I run an extra hour? All that. I could still do my work. With alcohol, it's impossible. So I lived that way for a while, a number of years, balancing my food issue and avoiding alcohol. And I'm not sure exactly when, but I passed my university, because, you know, internship and all that's pretty intense. I kind of relaxed a little with the non-alcohol and the non-pot, and I sort of picked that up. And I found this happy medium of I can drink a fair amount, maybe a half a bottle of wine at night, maybe a bottle, but, you know, nothing in my mind too bad, as long as I eat after. So I'd start off with the alcohol and then finish off with the food. And of course, the food meant I had mastered the art of throwing up. So it would probably be 2 or 3 binge purge cycles. And sometimes it would be just the food with more cycles, or just the alcohol and maybe no food. So I did that for a long time, even as a doctor, even as I was telling my patients, you should really stop, I didn't really make the connection, believe it or not, because doctors have a really hard time making the connection between sugar and diabetes. Even today, if Bart's, you know, you should try to lose 10 pounds and maybe not eat as much sugar, or you should stop drinking. And meanwhile, I was doing what I was doing. At some point when I got into addiction medicine, because at a certain point, I was doing mainly HIV medicine first. When that kind of got better, we found the PP1s and people were dying anymore. I then went into addiction medicine. And it took a while there until I just connected the dots. Here I am telling people to not drink alcohol. Well, I should stop drinking. And then the food thing. That took, I think it was now 20 years. Took a long time with it in my face. I mean, I'm very sympathetic to people who see it, but don't see it. So that's a long version of my story.
I think that's, it's really helpful, actually, to know that. Was there a turning point for you that you were like, this is something has to change?
Yeah, about the food, yes. It was, well, the turning point was always my weight that just kept going up and up and up. And I had this crazy belief that if the food is being served in a hospital, it's got to be healthy. Thought, well, I guess they vetted it. It must be okay. Anyway, I don't know if that's naive or just unwilling, like that denial that we talk, just don't see it, especially in yourself, you don't see it. But the turning point for me was when I was reading, I had had one occasion where, you see, the thing that would happen is if I would stop drinking completely, my food would go up. It was really like a yin-yang thing. And whenever I decided, well, I can have a drink, then if my food was under pretty good control, it would open it up. It was a real gatekeeper. So I realized, okay, I have to stop drinking. The food cravings were going up. And it just occurred to me one day, well, I'll treat this. I'm in addiction. I know what to do. I'll treat it like an addiction and I'll abstain. And I'll go through withdrawal and then it'll get better. And that worked. It worked for a few months, 3 months, 4 months. And then my partner brought in something delicious. And I thought, like everybody does, hey, it's been 4 months. I can probably have one now. And I would start again. And I think that was a trick, a cue, like, oh, something's funny here. But it wasn't really until I read Nora Volkoff. Dr. Nora Volkoff was was at that time the chair of the American Society of Addiction Medicine in the U.S., their journal published the very first articles on food addiction. I think that was 1997 or something like that. It had Nicola Vina in there and all the people that we now know in this field. And Nicola Vina was the one who, along with her professor colleague, who discovered that rats will choose food over cocaine. So those early studies, this was all in this one journal. And I read that and I thought, oh my God, this science is actually saying this is an addiction like any other. So I was right months ago. I have to treat this like an addiction. And so I had the validation for it. And when I did that, that really helped. It's like I got on board, like step one, I got on board. I knew I had a problem, but it took me a number of years to realize, and this is what we'll be talking about, I'm sure, that that's not enough. That stopping is just, that we have to do more, which is why I'm now on a campaign about this topic. It's not just about stopping, because that's just a diet. And you're going to go back because it's an addiction. And we'll talk more about that. But that was my aha moment.
Dr. Tarman, what is the connection then between food and alcohol addiction? I know we've heard things like it triggers the same part of the brain or like a dopamine response. But from a basic level, what is the connection?
Well, it's exactly that. So in that part of the brain where the reward center is, we call the limbic system, that's a part of the brain that acts on automatically. And my ability to think and have willpower always takes seconds later to respond. And so it's almost like it's an ingrained habit. And the ingrained habit is in that limbic system in something we call the nucleus accumbens, which is our pleasure response. And when dopamine fuses to, I have something and I feel good, a pathway has been cemented, or initially it's connected over multiple use and enhanced strong use, it becomes cemented into an autonomic thought almost. And when you see you have the autonomic thought, I'm in distress, I take a substance, that's thought. Before I even realize that I thought that, that's happened. And so addiction is just multiple layers of that that we now have to undo. And we can't really undo them. So we have to learn to live with them, and manage them, acknowledging that I will always have the propensity for this if I just pick up one. I always say addiction is the best we can get is remission, not cure. That's my perspective. I know that that's not everybody's, but that's my perspective. But anyway, have I explained that well enough? It's the dopamine circuitry in the brain. So anytime that's been over, it's there for a good reason to make us want to do things. But drugs and alcohol and some behaviors enhance that. And so that fusing is like extra fused. Yeah. And...
No, I remember going to AA meetings with my ex-husband and like NA meetings for myself. Yeah. And I would often see like the donuts at the back and the sugar and all of that. And then people smoking like crazy outside. Yeah. And like alcohol was never my issue. It was cocaine. But I have noticed that now I really do call it a food addiction. I didn't for a long time. There was a lot of bargaining going on. But I'm curious, how common is it for people to get sober from drugs or alcohol and then develop a food addiction? I know you said that it likely starts first with the food. And in fact, it did with me too, actually, when I look back on it. But is it common for people to just then start like doubling down on the sugar after they get sober from alcohol?
No, I don't
drugs.
Know. Actually, it would be a really good study to do that. I don't know if it's actually being done, but I see that clinically all the time. Like I work in a center for drugs and alcohol, although we did have a period of time where it was there for sugar as well or food. But anyway, most of the time, drugs and alcohol. And I always ask people, because I do a food talk there regularly, how many of you are eating far more than you normally would? And they all put up their hand. Like it's a pretty common phenomena. It's the rare person who doesn't. Now, do they declare it as a problem? No. What they say is, I'm gaining too much weight and I really better control my, sugar. But they don't see it as a problem. That's the thing. We don't see it as a problem. Even when I got my medallion at an AA meeting, what did they pull out but the cake? And I said, of course I'm cake.
Yes.
I don't eat sugar. You guys can have the cake. I'm not having cake. Right. So, So yes, it's often recommended if you have a craving, have something sweet instead, not realizing that you're just, you know, it's like saying have a cigarette instead. You're just perpetuating the addiction. And it's going to make it harder for you later when you try to quit. Because that's the other part of my story, which I didn't say, is that there was a time after many years of this, doing both at the same time. And then I stopped on my own. I think I got 4 years. This is outside of any program, just the Vera program. Then I realized, well, I'm gaining a lot of weight. I don't like this weight. And after like 4 years of sobriety, I relapsed again. And that really, to alcohol, that really hit me over the head. That all of a sudden I was starting to fantasize, you know, we call it euphoric recall. It would be really nice to have a glass of wine right now. Like, I used to like the taste of wine. And I'd say, Vera, stop that thinking. Like, I know the addiction tools. Don't go there. But it would creep in like this this thought that was persistent. And then finally I moved to the next stage, which was, well, if I just have one, that thing will go away, that persistent nagging. And of course, that's not what happened. But anyway, the neurochemistry of it, sugar and alcohol are really, they're sisters, like sisters. Because, I mean, I think that alcohol is basically, you know, sugar on steroids. You know, because what is alcohol made of but fermented carbohydrates, you know, fruits or grains? If we look at all the damage that alcohol does on the body, the very same damage happens with sugar, but slower, much slower. Like, we can get cirrhosis, we'll certainly get diabetes, we'll get some sort of dementia, like the same things. It's just that alcohol, you're drinking a chug load of sugar fermented, along with the other effects of alcohol, whereas sugar, without that effect of alcohol, although some of it is being distilled, as it were, in the body, but it's a gradual, slower process. You get to the same end point, though. So that's
really helpful to know. I didn't realize that
is sugar, like, together, addiction. Right.
I didn't realize that your consumption of sugar, I mean, it makes sense now that you say it. It's like, well, of course. But that it's just like you get the same medical, the health hazards, but just slower.
I can just say, because I think you'll appreciate that my sugar people don't really appreciate this as much, but you will, that if you look at the statistics of who gets liver transplants, it is actually more what we call non-alcoholic fatty liver disease than fatty liver than alcoholic fatty liver disease.
More people
getting transplants, cirrhosis leading to transplants from basically the diet, because where else are we getting that?
I watch a lot of medical dramas, and when somebody comes in and needs a liver transplant, it's kind of like, it's kind of like when someone has lung cancer and never smoked, when they need a liver transplant, they say, and I never even drank.
Yeah.
But so you assume it's not self-inflicted, right? Like, I just assumed that, like, it's like idiopathic liver disease.
Yeah.
And so that is fascinating.
That is fascinating.
Somebody also told me this. I love this. And I say this to my boyfriend. He's a tofi, which is like thin on the outside, fat on the inside, right?
Yes.
And so just because somebody presents as healthy doesn't mean they're not still consuming really bad foods. Like, it's like you could still go in and have diabetes, or you could still have liver disease, but no one thinks it to look at you that you caused it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, I mean, to say you caused it is also a little bit harsh, because it's an addiction, right? Like, and unlike alcohol, well, alcohol too is pushed down our throats pretty much, but sugar, like, it's even before you are conscious, mom is giving it to you. Like it's,
sure.
It's so ubiquitous. And sometimes it's the only food that's available in your environment. So it's self-inflicted. I like to say it's industry inflicted, because they don't care.
Yeah. I agree.
Nor just the alcohol industry care. Like, they just don't care.
So I once did an intuitive eating program.
Oh my. Hey,
and we'll get to that more later. But one of the things that actually, you know what? Maybe it was like 3 years ago and I was doing it, and then I picked up your book. And I went back to the leader of the intuitive eating program and I said, listen, I'm in recovery from cocaine addiction. I have ADHD. I have a very addictive brain. And I really actually think my eating, my sugar it's a food addiction. And she said, there's no such thing as food addiction. She said, it's only emotional eating. So what is the difference between emotional eating and food addiction?
Yeah, so it's interesting because that was from somebody who was promoting the concept of intuitive eating, which comes from the eating disorder world. And the eating disorder world comes from the psychology, the psychologists. Most people who are treating eating disorders as opposed to food addiction are psychologists. Or the doctors who have a psychologist on board or like they're using that literature. Because the medical realm of disordered eating is either the bariatric world, which we could talk about that too, like the hormones and how you can manipulate hormones. That's all the medications, like Ozempic. Or it's the psychological aspect of eating, which is eating disorders. And they come from the point of view, the eating disorder people, and in the background, the bariatric people, from the idea that we eat to resolve our emotional distress. And so emotional eating, I'm eating when I'm having poor emotions. Maybe I'm too happy or too sad or depressed. And so we basically take a little bit of a drug. I mean, they don't say that, but we take a little bit of food, which resolves the feeling. So I guess that is a little bit of food addiction piece in there. So you use food as opposed to something else, like running or talking to a friend, both of which help, but take a while to work. Our brain always wants what works right away. Like we are very impulsive. This part of our brain is the impulsive part of our brain. So sugar, alcohol, whatever, when you're in emotional distress, are a good immediate solution. But this crowd of people will say, so the goal is don't focus on the sugar because or the alcohol or the whatever, because it's the emotional problem. So what we need to do is look at the emotions, sort them out, do DBT, CBT, whatever therapy, mindfulness, whatever it takes, resolve the problem. And then you won't need the drug, the pacifier to feel better. And then because you don't need the pacifier, you can then intuitively eat because our body does actually, we could intuitive eating does exist. It's a real phenomena. It's possible, but it's only possible in an environment where there's no drug food. Like if it's real food, if we're eating whole food, non-ultra processed food, intuitive eating is possible. But they forget that piece. They say you should be able to intuitively eat anything because we don't want to focus on the food. We want on the emotions. So emotional eating is when I eat to deal with my emotions, as opposed to food addiction, which is I don't care what my emotions are. I put this thing into my body. It creates this desire to have more just because I put it in there, regardless of the mood. I could have been completely neutral or happy, calm, fine. Like when I relapsed back to my sugar because my partner had food in the house, I was fine. I was in bed. I was comfortable. Watching, reading my book or something. And all of a sudden there's this little thing there. And I thought, well, I'll have a little bit. And then there we go. I then had my mind full of, okay, I just had that. Did I have another without looking like I'm a pig? Maybe I'll have some later when it's quiet and everyone's asleep. Like all those kind of thoughts started and they weren't there 20 minutes before. So food addiction, put something in, started it off. It's a very different thing. So your person, Kathleen, does not believe in that phenomenon.
No, does not. And actually sent me articles about that original cocaine sugar study and was like, this has been debunked and blah, blah,
really?
Blah. Yes. And yes. And it threw me for a loop. Yeah, I'll dig it up. But it really threw me for a loop. And it is actually only recently that I would say in the last 6 months that I've come to truly view that I have a food addiction. And Sonia is going to ask a little bit about intuitive eating in a second, but I can see though how intuitive eating can work if it's just whole foods. But if I were to have any sugar and I'm talking any sugar, it unleashes a monster in me. Like I cannot stop.
It's the same monster as your cocaine monster problem. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a big monster.
And you know, but it might not have been as big because, you know, food addiction, sugar addiction is more like cigarettes. It's a relentless background buzz, but irritant. It's not like, oh, I have to have this or I'm going to die. It's like, I have to have this because I can't be still. I can't settle. It's more like a cigarette addiction. But cigarette addiction, damn hard to stop, as is sugar addiction. It's just, do you want something that's persistently in the background, never letting you have a moment of silence? Or do you want the crazy drama of quitting alcohol or cocaine or opiates or whatever? But they're still, in the end, they'll get you both. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I remember when Kathleen first started talking about the food addiction maybe 2 years ago, and we were like, we should treat this like recovery. Yeah. This is so similar to how I would describe when I quit cigarettes, but even when I quit alcohol, it wasn't dissimilar. So can I ask either Kathleen or Dr. Tarman, what is intuitive eating?
Go ahead, Dr. Tarman. I defer to you.
Intuitive eating is sort of premised on the idea that our body knows what it needs. And so if we don't have the distractions of the external world, like emotions or something, or too much available, we'll eat just as much as we need. So I guess the idea is, the term that I've heard often is, I really need a piece of chocolate. We all like chocolate because chocolate actually has a lot of minor intoxicants in it. You know, the caffeine in it, the sugar in it, the cocoa itself, which inspires endorphins. Like it's actually considered one of the most addictive foods. So they might say, well, it's probably the, I forget what it's called, the flavonoids or something else that the body is craving. And then so that you kind of choose foods that you, we call it intuitively, like just what you intuitively want at that moment, your body is telling you it needs. And so it would be a good idea to really listen to those attunements so that we fulfill our body the way we need to, which would be great if they're real foods. But when they're little chemicals designed to make you addictive, you're just walking into a trap. And the intuitive eating folks just don't recognize that. So I don't know, Kathleen, did that kind of capture what you did?
It did. And one of the things that when you were defining it, it brought up in my memory, sugar foods, like sweet foods, are called play foods. So you don't call them bad foods. They don't want to they don't want to assign negativity to them. So in fact, they call them play foods, which actually assigns positive, meaning like, okay, you can have a little bit, like you just play foods. But for me, it doesn't work. And it just doesn't. And I finally, after years, like I'm 46, so probably after 38 years, I'm finally coming to like this point of, this is an addiction for me. But I, you know, Sonia, I think, you know, we were talking about intuitive eating and whether or not, like, I'm curious, can it coexist with recovery from food addiction? I mean,
yes.
I don't know.
So it depends on where a person is on the food addiction spectrum. Like, I think that after a certain point, especially if a person's been doing a lot of binging and purging, which was my story, I have to be really careful. But not everybody has to be as careful. Like, I do think there's a continuum, a progressive continuum. And we know that with alcohol and whatever, even smoking, if you haven't done enough, you might be able to just stop and then have a few. Like, I do see people literally just having a few. But I think that there's a point at which we're crossed, and that's what we usually call the alcoholics and the addicts. And there's no going back. But it still is a progressive thing. And so that some people, if they progress long enough, they just even eating real food might be too triggering. So that eating a bag of cherries, everybody knows you're going to have more than just two or three. But the food addict is going to have the bag and then go out and get another bag. And then they're sitting on the toilet with diarrhea and they're still having cherries. Like they're using despite negative consequences. So for them, intuitive eating doesn't work. So I, for example, and I don't recommend this to anybody who doesn't need to do it, but I will weigh and measure my food so that I don't have to make that decision of, I'm going to allow myself four cherries. That's part of the thing. That's part of what I'm calling my sobriety. And so if I have more than that, I'm not sober anymore. So it, like you kind of, but I don't even do that because I don't need the aggravation of wanting more cherries when I can't have them.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
But there are people who are not as advanced or whatever. Maybe their pathways haven't been infused in a different way. Because I do think there's a big variation. Food addiction is one term, but it means many things to many people. But there's a lot of people who can actually, once they get rid of the ultra-processed food, which is pretty universally addictive, and the sugar, there's a lot of in-between foods like cashews and cherries and bananas and stuff, that yogurt, cheese, that some people can eat intuitively, which means that they want it and then they can stop. And others can't. They just know, if I have a bit of cheese, I want the big, all of the topping. And so intuitive eating is theoretically possible in the food addiction world if it's real food, but it may not be, depending on the stage of your...
Okay.
Yeah. And that's where it changes. Like, I can't eat cashews, but I can eat walnuts.
Mm.
I like walnuts. That's why.
So is that why you don't like walnuts?
Have the same pleasure as cashews or peanuts.
Well, I'm curious, would you start eating cashews and then notice in yourself?
Oh my God, yes. Well, it's in my book.
Okay.
If you look in the epilogue, I know everything about addiction. Well, you know, I know a lot about addiction. There I am. I take a tablespoon of cashew butter. And, you know, that tablespoon was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I was still calling it a tablespoon. And I just realized, no, this is an aggravation they don't need. So it creeps up on you. And so to some degree, this is a physiological addiction, like a drug, creates behavior. But it's also a psychological one. Like, why is it that cashews suddenly became addictive? There was probably like psychological stuff. Like, it's not purely chemical. I think it's also a psychological phenomenon. It's quite a complex thing.
Yeah, I like the definition of the psychological phenomenon, but Kathleen knows I struggle with this, which is how to make choices when I'm looking at food. So when we talk about the sugar addiction, like the non-whole foods, right? Like, I know broccoli, I don't have to check, but so I have been struggling with what milk to use in my tea. And so I asked ChatGPT, which has the least added sugar. And so is that what we're looking at when we're talking about something that triggers our sugar addiction? Are we talking about added sugar? Are we talking about like a banana with natural sugar?
So that's a very good question. So I'm going to give you the sort of universal answer. And then again, for those people who are at the extreme end, that it may not work for them. But so the general answer is, we're talking added sugar and ultra processed food. So I have a podcast called Food Junkies, and we just interviewed somebody, hasn't dropped yet, but it will soon. And they said, it's not even the macronutrients like the sugar and the fat, it's the combinations and it's the processing of the food itself. That is another additive, is the processing of the food. And then there's the additives themselves. So there's a lot more than just sugar. It's the added sugar, refined sugar, and then all the other stuff that comes with it. But if we're looking at fruit and we're looking at dairy, there's sugar in that too. But for the most part, I think people can do that intuitively if they're not damaged, because we have in our body, I guess it's a kind of intuitiveness. If I think about a date or a fig, which is way too sweet for me, but for some people they can do it because there's a ton of fiber in that. And so, and then there's the skin of the apple and the skin of a lot of fruits. If you eat that too, it regulates it in such a way that it's not going to overpower you. But if you extract it, the sugar out, and then put it into a package of ultra processed crap, then it's too powerful. So with you, Sonia, I would actually say my version of ChatGPT would say, actually, you want to eat, drink full milk or double cream, because it's the fat that will satiate you and make you satisfied.
And I worry about my cholesterol. I do try to look at anything that I can, and I can look at the ingredients and the amount I look at. But I do not shy away as much from fat as I did in like the 90s, right? The 90s, we were like, let's get the chips with 2/3 less fat. Right. And so,
I think unless you're diabetic or have metabolic disease of some sort, so maybe the cholesterol as part of that, most fruits and vegetables are okay and dairy is okay. But then if you're starting to get some other issues, then you may have to cut down and eat fruits more on the berries side as opposed to on the cherries side.
And so this is something, I mean, we talk about this question a lot in recovery. Mm-hmm. And when I talk to women considering, do I have a problem? Have I hit rock bottom? Do you think some people can manage their cravings with moderation, or is full abstinence the better route?
Yeah. So that's in the addiction world, we'll say almost like harm reduction. I think that if a person has crossed the line, I actually wrote an article on that line, that line of absence, when you go from maybe being able to moderate once in a while to crossing. When you cross that line, I don't think moderation is possible. That would be like saying that Kathleen should be able to have a little bit of cocaine on New Year's Eve. Like, come on, why not?
Great.
It was like that time when I was in bed, comfortable, content, ready to read and then fall asleep. And all of a sudden, now the night was filled with sugar plum fairies. I couldn't stop thinking about it. So there was no moderation possible for me, and because I crossed that line. And there's actually more research now. Like you mentioned, Kathleen, that study had been debunked. I mean, there's so much research now that confirms this. And now there's more and more clinical evidence that confirms that abstinence is essential. We may use harm reduction or moderation to entice the person. All right, if I tell you, Sonia, you can't have your ice cream anymore, you're going to say, well, I'm not really an addict. I don't need to. So we'll say, well, can you cut down? Because you're worried about your blood work parameters. And if you can do that, then that means that I'm not going to say you're not affected by the addictive qualities of food, because that's universal. Those foods are made to be addictive. It hasn't taken over your life. And if you can keep the moderation to a point where you don't cross that line, you might be, quote, one of the lucky ones, and you will be able to moderate once in a while. But I think anybody listening has to decide, have I crossed that line? And if you've crossed the line in another addiction, likely you have here, but you don't know it yet.
It's like you're pickled. So a pickle can't go back to a cucumber, but a cucumber can become a pickle. Yeah. So it's trying to figure out, am I a pickle?
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's right. Exactly.
So I am definitely past the point of moderation for sugar, and it's been a hard thing for me to come to terms with. But one of the things that I struggle with is if I'm going to be abstinent from sugar, it feels a bit different than alcohol and then certainly cocaine. It feels different because sometimes sugar sneaks itself into things that I don't know about. And so, am I still sober? Have I relapsed? What's happened? Yeah.
Well, salad dressing.
Exactly. Well, one thing we do is we become very familiar with our foods. It doesn't go in my mouth until I've investigated. But if you have a mistake, like let's say you're at a bar and you're drinking water, sparkling water, and you have somebody's drink, you notice it, and you'll probably get some impact of the hit, of the alcohol. But my guess is that because you have not yet opened up your permissibility to, well, I'll have another one now. You might be safe with that. And your sponsor would probably not say, oh, you got to go back to day one. They would probably go, that was a mistake. That's right. Going to happen the same here. But the thing that happens is that if you go, oh, you know, that was kind of nice. And the thinking might go, well, yeah, I wonder, could I have a bit more? Like, that's the thing.
Right.
And if you can catch that, that's why food addiction, like any other addiction, needs a recovery platform. Like I said, stopping is number one, but there's still life to live after. And you're going to run into those mistakes. So usually when people intentionally pick up again, they don't have that response that I did in bed that night. They'll have that, well, that was nice. And I only had one, you know, I had a bit of somebody's pie and I was fine. But then before you know it, the next week, you're having one piece of pie. And then before you know it, you're now having a pie every day. Now, that might take 3 or 4 mm-hmm. weeks. It's not immediate like it might be with a drug. Sugar is, it's like, it's this pesky under the radar thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is for me. You know, I can't even have dates. Yeah, I thought I would be able to, but not right now. I
never have them anyway. I mean, I haven't had them for years and years and years. Dates are just, there's just too much fructose in them.
Yeah, but for you, Sonia, you don't have. I don't think it's as like powerful.
Like
for me, I call it like it's my gateway. I will convince myself it's a date. It's natural. I can have it. And then I have it. And then before I know it, I'm like stuffing my face with ultra processed sugar. There's like a gateway for me.
I think what's hard too about the abstinence is it's different than alcohol. I'll just talk about my other sister-in-law, right? Had seen me drunk a lot. And so she is happy when I say, oh, no, I don't drink, you know, when I'm around people. But I think with the sugar thing, it's like, oh, Kathleen, you're not going to have a piece of your daughter's birthday cake.
Yeah,
like, Kathleen, why are you being so difficult about? And so people don't.
Yeah.
There is a stigma attached to it. So, like, I know we're going out to eat in a couple of weeks. And I'm like, yeah, I wonder how are you going to navigate? Like, if
not only that, I'm making my boyfriend on Thursday, it's his birthday, a banana cream pie. Now, luckily, I don't like banana cream pie. So it's not going to be as. But I'm hosting his whole family. They're going to be eating his birthday pie, and I am not.
Definitely hard because it's there everywhere. So that's the other. It's not just you have it by accident, but trying not to have it and people wanting you to have it. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
Because we don't live in a society that respects this addiction.
No.
If we go out to eat and you're like, oh, I just want to know what's in that salad dressing. You'd be like, what's your problem? I won't say that, but I mean, I can see people thinking.
They do. Yeah.
That, like, I know even my friend Anna won't have anything that has canola oil, right? And so when we go out, she'll be like, I just want to know if this was fried, if we're going to eat something fried. Was it fried in canola oil? Right. And so I can see sometimes the servers, like, rolling their eyes, but I get it now. I get it. I respect it.
Yeah.
So why is sugar so powerful of a substance for so many of us?
It's the fuel for the brain. Like, sugar is glucose fructose, and the glucose is fuel for the brain. So we're already primed to like it. Nobody, when people say I have a sweet tooth, everybody has a sweet tooth, but some more than others. Like, we're born with a sweet tooth and it's fuel. So if I'm really hungry because I haven't eaten for a long time, that's why it's hungry and lonely tired is a dangerous thing. My fuel is down and I'm going scrambling to, like, it kicks in the survival instinct. Now, if you're eating real food, that won't happen for 4 to 6 to 8 hours. And then you get really hungry and you're not going to want to have a piece of Brussels sprout. You're going to want to have something that's energy dense to give you the energy right away to feel better because you're becoming hypoglycemic. If you're eating sugar all the time, then that's going to happen within an hour or two. So that you're basically being driven by the nose by this hypoglycemic response, which is the hormonal piece of a sugar addiction. We've been just talking about what's called the hedonic part. But the hormonal part is where you just become hypoglycemic. You're truly hungry, and that's driving food behavior as well, which, by the way, that's where the drugs like Ozempic kick in, as they initially kick in on this hormonal piece. But they're also now saying that they also kick in on the dopamine. But that more is to be revealed about that. Later.
We talked a lot about the sugar piece, the food addiction piece, what it kind of looks like, why we might be addicted to sugar. We want to spend some time talking about recovery. How do we heal from this? Do you think that recovery needs to look different for each person? Or are there some essentials that you think would work for most people with food addiction.
Well, if you're buying the idea that food is addictive, then that's the first part of recovery. It's like step one in the 12-step program. Yeah. I admit that I'm powerless over sugar. And I just to go back to your last question, just very quickly. So sugar is because it's fuel. It's the number one, almost universal. And then flour, because it breaks down into sugar very quickly, is next. And then everything else after that is kind of up for grabs. So you have to accept that this is an addiction. And then because we know that our brain is wired to crave the memory of something that was good, we now have to live with that memory. So, you know, it's that pickle, you're no longer a cucumber. You're burdened with this knowledge and you're burdened with this whole interplay of neuronal connections, associations, where we're constantly being triggered. Mm-hmm. And what do we do with that? So recovery is about what do we do with that? And the first thing you have to do is stop the substance, which you have to believe it's a problem in the first place, and then you have to stop it. So that's abstinence. And the moderation piece, I would suggest you try moderation first. Can you just cut down? And if you can, good for you. Just keep it cut down so that you don't progress. But most of us can't. So then we say, okay, we can't. So abstinence is the next piece. And you have to do that first, I think. Some people will say, going to deal with the psychology of making you want to pick up. That's part of the old eating disorder paradigm. I think that, you know, if you were drinking, Kathleen, I'm not going to have you sit in my office and say, let's work on your issues so that you stop drinking. You're not going to stop, you know, like you got to, you know, leave the guy or leave the job and then you'll stop drinking and then we can get to it. And you say, I'm sorry, no matter what your circumstances are, you got to stop the booze. Got to stop. So same with this. You got to stop the sugar because you're drunk otherwise. Now, food drunk is not necessarily the same as alcohol drunk, but it's still something. And it's still an emotional mess, miasma of neurochemicals. And you can't use the tools that we need to heal, to forgive, to accept, to love ourselves. All those things that part of recovery are not available when I'm drunk on food or booze or drugs. So we've got to stop. And then we have to do all of the recovery techniques. And those are the very same tools that we use for all other drugs. Because at a certain point, NA looks like AA, looks like CA. It's all the same tools. It's almost the same books, not exactly, but almost. And similarly with food, it's the same. But when we talk about individualizing, I mean, obviously it's individualized. Even the food plan is individualized. Like after no sugar, no flour, some people can eat grains, they can eat nuts, they can eat dairy. I'm only giving myself as an example because I'm here, but I don't do sugar, flour, grains, and I weigh and measure. That's one version works for me. It's not going to work for you. Kathleen, that might have you running away. I'm not going to do that. Take a scale into a restaurant? No way. I don't even want to ask about the flour or the oil. Yes, it's individualized according to what you need and what you're willing to do.
Because I know for myself, Dr. Tarman, it's sugar, it's flour, like any sort of white flour. And for me, it's dairy. Dairy like lights off the same. I get the same thing from dairy.
Dairy's got endorphins in it. So you're probably a little bit attuned to that.
Yeah. That's for sure. More.
Yeah. Kathleen, if you bring a scale to dinner, I will support you, but I will make fun of you. Yeah. I will laugh at you.
That's horrible.
No, no. But I'm going to support it.
I have a scale. Yeah.
Bring it. Bring it.
Exactly. I fear going out for that reason. And often I will bring my own food so I don't have to weigh and measure it. Or I will have a certain amount. You can ask the server to scale. Sometimes they will. I don't want to do that anymore. But anyway, it is navigating a life that is different than others. There's no question about that. And it's awkward.
Yeah, it's so much easier to say, oh, I don't drink. Or it's so much easier when people say, oh, do you have food allergies? Mm-hmm. But this is different.
I'll eat beforehand and just go and have coffee.
Yeah. So are we doing enough to talk about food addiction in the recovery community? Does OA kind of fill that gap?
We're not, because people who are alcoholics, cocaine addicts, whatever, are still people in society who don't get the concept of food addiction. I'm going to be, I don't know, politically incorrect here, but I've been to one international conference. And by the way, I'm going to the one in July, if any of you guys are going.
Which conference? Kathleen will go.
The international. The International AA. Well, it's AA. That's why.
Oh,
it's AA. So we don't necessarily.
Yeah, necessarily. You don't follow the.
We like it.
Yeah.
We like it. I've been to NA. We like it.
So no, we don't quite get it. Now, OA's been around since 1961. So clearly somebody got it that, hey, there's something here. But OA it's the biggest one. It's the biggest fellowship. And I'm very glad it's there because it does have a public face for people to go to. But there are actually about 10 other split offs from OA, or they started their own, that are food addiction related because there are so many individual needs. So there's FAA, Food Addicts in Recovery Anonymous, Food Addicts Anonymous, there's Gray Sheet Anonymous, there's Low Carb Anonymous. Like, there's a lot of them now that are using a 12-step program, community-based, to help people. And I encourage people strongly to go to one of them. Now, because I've got my campaign going, I have a Facebook group that we actually hit 30,000 members like yesterday. That is full of people who are either newcomers or old timers that are coming on to give advice. Also, we're developing, I'd say in the last 5 years, huge amounts of people who are now food addiction aware coaches, nutritionists, counselors, to counteract the intuitive eating people, to say, you know, here are people who are doing coaching, et cetera, it might be low carb, keto, whatever, plant-based. But we're doing it with a food addiction focus in mind. So those services are now are developing as our community is now developing. This is all new. OA's been around since 61. These have been around 5 years maybe. But it's exploding right now.
So you're saying, Dr. Tarman, that if someone is struggling with food addiction or they think they might be struggling with food addiction, to reach out for support in one of these different areas, either OA or one of the branches of OA or even your Facebook group, we'll make sure we get that information for our show notes as
well. And in that Facebook group, which is secular, you don't have to be 12-step, there are also free virtual groups there that are secular, and they kind of advertise themselves that they're free as if you don't want to do a 12-step thing, try this. So it's the same idea, support group, but it doesn't mention any of the literature. And then people developed programs that people can join as well, but you have to pay for that. So our community supports, and I would really strongly recommend, because it's so ubiquitous, because it's everywhere and you're going to run into mistakes all the time, that a person have that platform of support so that they can say, like you, Kathleen, I mistakenly did this thing. Am I in trouble now? Just by virtue of saying that, you're putting yourself into a safe bubble of protection. That's what we have to do to protect ourselves from the onslaught of daily, momentary. The moment I put on the TV, I get a thought of food because I'm watching. So we need this constant basis to buffer against that. And nobody should try to do this alone. They won't do it. Willpower works, but you're a dry drunk. We know this in addiction. It's not about saying no. It's about how to not have to say no. Put yourself in environments where you don't have to say no, because it's just.
Well, that leads me to my next question. Mm-hmm. What helped you, Dr. Tarman, to learn to trust yourself around food again?
Well, I in as much as I do, I like bring a scale with me because I don't trust my ability to eyeball, you know, one tablespoon of nut butter. I guess what I've done is I've recognized here's where I have strengths. I don't worry about dairy too much. So I have a food plan that I don't decide on impulsively. So this is what I do. And this makes me not think about food except when I'm eating and food prepping, which is good because otherwise it would have been 24/7 thinking about food. I will prep my food ahead of time, plan it out, how much, how many ounces of this and that. I have a sponsor if you're in a program, it's not a sponsor, it's your coach. I'll tell them what I'm going to eat. And then at the end of the day, I'll say I was successful or not successful because I want to be sober or abstinent. And then I do a lot of meetings. It's like doing this. It's like step 12. It's spreading the message. I do this, and this confirms my own beliefs, and it's service. And that's, I believe in the concept of service just in and of itself.
What does freedom or serenity look like to you when it comes to eating? Dr. Charman?
It means that I sit down at the table, which is already taken care of. I know what I'm going to eat. I know how much I'm going to eat. And then I can enjoy, because that's the thing about when you don't eat sugar, you love vegetables again. You love food again. And so I sit down. I don't worry about food anymore. I don't worry about my weight. Is this going to make me gain weight? I'm going to be afraid of the scale. And I can purely enjoy the food because I'm hungry, because I haven't snacked in between. And then when I'm finished the food, yeah, there's a part of me that could still keep eating, but I'm good. I can get up and then I can go and do something else and not think about food. And when I do think about food, because I'm getting a bit hungry, it's a couple of hours later, I just think, well, I'll have a really delicious meal in a few hours. I'm good. And I'm good. So food serenity for me is being appropriately hungry, enjoying my food, not being deprived. Then the rest of my life between my meals, I get to live my life.
That's serenity.
Yeah. Now, if my life is crap that time, I'm not going to use food to make that different. I'm going to use something to make the crap different, but not eat.
What advice, Dr. Charman, would you give to someone who feels stuck in this food addiction cycle and doesn't know where to start?
I would say read, learn about the condition. So you've done that. The next step I would do is start talking to people, getting support, talking to people. So I would suggest an easy way to do that. I don't want to self-promote here, but join the Facebook group. There's other Facebook groups too. Just make sure they're abstinent ones. There's one called No Sugar, No Flour, No Grains Recipe. And that's a really big group too, 70,000 or something. Join something there. Start hearing people talk about all the things that are in your head that you didn't realize you thought about, so that you feel less and less alone. And then more and more like, actually, this is kind of normal for some of us. Like, you won't feel so weird and like, why am I like this? It'll be more like, well, I'm just like this. So when you start feeling less weird, more normal, I'm not alone, then some of the suggestions, like, well, I literally can get away without not having sugar one day at a time, 1 minute at a time, that actually works. Mm-hmm. You see people talking about that. It starts to kind of infiltrate and works that way.
Yeah.
So I would say get support. Join a group. Start reading that material. Don't expect to change right away. But if you do want to make one change right away, get rid of refined sugar. Do those two things, like soda, and get rid of the overt candy and the muffins and stuff like that. And then start working on the other stuff.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Charman. I mean, I read your book a few years ago. I loved it. I really enjoyed it. It is beyond a pleasure for me to have you on today to chat with us about food addiction. I learned a lot, and I'm sure that Sonia did too. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. And if I can just say one message of hope to end, that is that if a person does decide to quit sugar, it only takes 10 days, 2 weeks to get over the worst of it. Then you're free. Then the challenge is to stay free.
So I'm on day four.
What are you, you're on day four?
I relapsed.
You didn't.
That's what happened. See? I'm on day four. But that's good to know. That's really good to know. That gives me hope. That gives me hope.
I want to leave with a message of hope.
Yes. Yes, for sure. And thank you all for joining us and listening to Sisters in Sobriety. And we will see you next week.
This was Sisters in Sobriety.
Thank you for listening and being with us today.
If you want to learn more about sobriety and meet your community, find us at sistersinsobriety.substack.com.
Are you a sister in sobriety? Then reach out on social media. We'd love to hear from you.
If you're feeling generous, leave us 5 stars and a review and follow us wherever you listen.
You'll never miss an episode. Until next time.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.